Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our conversation continues with Robert Doerr, Commissioner of the New York City Human Resources Administration. Also joining us in our conversation from IBM is Stu Advinsky. Robert, every year, I understand HRA collects about $500 million in child support payments for New York City's children. And I understand it's a valuable component of the anti-poverty programs for those in the lower income brackets. Would you tell us more about your efforts in this area? What are some of the key initiatives under this program?
The child support program is one of the most misunderstood programs in social services. It began as a device to get the other parent to contribute at least something toward the livelihood of the family or to recoup welfare benefits. Back in the 70s, it began. As welfare reform kicked in the 90s, and less people were on welfare, we had a lot of low-income single-parent families who were not on welfare but needed that additional resource to be consistent and reliable on a monthly basis. And that's what's happened in the Child Support Enforcement Program. We basically are enforcing orders that were made in court. So it's not like the agency made them. They're made in court in a family court setting. They're supposed to be commensurate with the ability of the non-custodial parents' income and ability to pay. So they're based on a percentage of income. And we make efforts to make sure that those payments come in every month. And the biggest device we use is we garnish wages, which is a requirement of the law. So you can even on the first day, even before you're in arrears, you're required to pay through your employer. It's easier for you. It's easier for us, the agency that has to keep track of it, and it's easier for the families. So we collect about total more than $600 million. Of that, about $300 million goes to families who used to be on welfare. So mostly single mothers with kids. They were once on welfare. They're still relatively low income. And that additional $100, $200 a month, $250 a month adds to their resources over and above their earnings and what other benefit programs they may also have. So that's been a successful anti-poverty initiative as well as one in which provides some equity in the responsibilities of parenthood. If you have a child and you may not want to live with them, you may not be able to get along with the other parent, but either way, you need to provide support. You have a certain legal responsibility, and we enforce that. There's all sorts of administrative devices we impose on people who don't comply. We suspend driver's licenses for failure to pay. It used to be that if you got a parking ticket in New York City, the power of the law would come down on you faster and more aggressively than if you didn't pay your child support. Well, that's not true anymore. We move very quickly to say to someone, you're not paying. We seize bank accounts. We get the tax department to look into your tax situation and to do their enforcement mechanisms. So it's pretty aggressive enforcement of a very fundamental societal responsibility, which is to provide financial support to your children. Now, one of the problems, and I'm probably going off too much on child support, but it doesn't get as much attention. But one of the problems is it becomes all about money. And so what we've done at HRA and what I felt was important, not just new twists, but new fundamental part of the program, is we've said we also would like to help get fathers particularly, but the absent parent, more involved in the emotional life of the child. So we've done programs on that. We've encouraged it in public service announcements. We've had parties and gatherings. We've funded programs. We monitor cases. We've made our child support enforcement program not be so tough on non-custodial parents and treat them as customers as well. So when they come in and don't understand their order, we try to respond to them. And we also are willing to look at arrears balances in appropriate circumstances and forgive arrears that are never going to be collected, particularly arrears that are owed to the government. So, and we brought that sort of other side of the program in, and that's been, I think, really successful.
I understand your agency is also responsible for administering one of the largest food stamp programs in the country, with more than 1 million New Yorkers drawing benefits from the program. Would you tell us more about the program and the various initiatives you've pursued to increase access to the food stamp program?
Food stamps is an interesting program because people used to associate it almost entirely with welfare. When welfare reform passed in the early 90s, food stamp was a different program. There were some reforms in the food stamp program, but those of us in the business had to figure out that. It took us a while, and I think we figured it out, which is that it's a work support. It is a supplement to people who are in the workforce are working, but the return for work is not sufficient for them to be able to afford what they need for their families. And so We've marketed it a little bit. We've made it more accessible. We've made the time frame for people to apply and receive benefits, I think, faster and more convenient. We expanded our hours. The state and the federal government have relaxed certain rules so that more people are eligible or the benefits amounts are a little more generous. And the result is that we have this big group, more than a million New Yorkers, who men, women, and children, who are benefiting this program but still working. The belief in among your sort of regular American, who I'm respectful of, that if you receive a benefit, you ought to be doing your part too, or showing some personal responsibility, is still intact. They're working, but they just need a little extra to make ends meet between the end of the month. So that's how the food stamp program has changed. The caseload has gotten high during these difficult economic times, and as more people have seen the benefits of taking advantage of it.
And how have you leveraged technology in particular, and also the outreach campaigns you mentioned and streamlining?
Well, we do things over the phone now. Phone is a piece of technology. We do things with mail. We have people not come in. They just send in mail recertifications. We have a paperless office system. We have very sophisticated computer systems where we are able to have our workers process an application a lot quicker. So we've done a lot with regard to making technology more useful for our workers and our clients. We have Access NYC, where people can go on and see if they're eligible and then maybe bring in an application that's filled out. And we hope to, in the coming year, have online applications and an ability for people to submit their documents through online devices. And the other thing we've done is we've allowed people who are not necessarily city employees but work for a not-for-profit or a church or a community group to begin the application process, to gather the information, to get on the computer, to submit the stuff, have us receive it, not have to double data enter it, and then begin the process of it. And those things have made people who think they might be eligible and might benefit from it be more willing to take advantage of it, and it's been successful, I think.
One of the other large programs in your portfolio is the medical assistance program, which makes you responsible for the administration of public health insurance in New York City. What initiatives are you pursuing to increase access to both public and lower-cost private health insurance?
Here, New York City and New York State are really, I think, well ahead of the rest of the country in covering the uninsured. We have higher income rules than the rest of the country. That's partly due to state initiatives, but we implement them. We have automated recertification processes so that the information comes in on a very abbreviated document that we're able to quickly process. We use facilitated enrollers, that is, you know, non-government entities who can help people get their applications in order. And as a result, the Census Bureau reported last month that according to their survey, which is the official survey, only 5.7% of New York City's children were uninsured. That's amazing. I mean, that's virtual universal coverage. Now, a lot of them are covered by public health insurance, which is Medicaid or Family Health Plus or CHIP, Children's Health Insurance Program. But there's still a big chunk covered by private employers. And that's a tremendous record. And I'm a little worried that in Washington, what they're talking about is how do we get the rest of the country to catch up with New York? And we may not get any benefits out of what's coming, but we'll get to see everybody else get all sorts of help, which we appeared to have figured out ourselves. But the main focus has been that we have not made the eligibility determination process overly burdensome on applicants. And we've got them the card, we've got them covered, and then we make the recert as simple as possible. And so that what often happens in Medicaid programs is people get insured, they get the card, their recert period comes up, and they drop off. And we've been able to reduce that dramatically. Now, I think 70% of the people that receive our mailer telling them they're up for recertification in Medicaid return it, which is very big in any kind of mailing. And of those who return it, 95% are determined eligible in the appropriate time. I think we may be one of the biggest providers of health insurance, HRA, in the country with 2.5 million covered individuals. Notwithstanding that we provide a lot of public health insurance, there's a lot available in the private marketplace. And there are a lot of people that aren't eligible for public health insurance. And that's another one of the big discussions in Washington is how to solve that problem. What we wanted to do is have people have the information at their fingertips to see what's available. So the health insurance link is a website. It's available to anybody. You go on at nyc.highlink. I think that'll get you there. You put in your information, not necessarily your personal information, but your situation, your income, your residence, what kind of health insurance you want, high deductibles, low deductibles. And then you put, tell me what's available, and we come back with what's available in that marketplace and who you should call and what it'll cost. We're getting, I think, hundreds of links. And it's www.nyc.gov/highlink, H-I-L-I-N-K. So that's what we've got. We've got thousands of hits on it since we announced it. The mayor came and announced that he was very proud of it. The mayor, you know, is a technology guy, and he likes to see us using technology to help citizens. The only issue I do want to caution listeners, or something that they would, of course, know if they've thought about it, is that we may give them what's available, but we don't talk about the affordability. I mean, it may come back and you say, wow, the lowest cost insurance package that I could get for my situation is $5,000 a year or $10,000 a year, and that may be more than the person wants to pay. But we felt, let's at least get them the information and know what's out there in the private marketplace. And that's what HighLink is.
I'd like to ask you a little bit about the Temporary Cash Assistance Program. What is it, and what benefits are available to those who are on public assistance longer than the 60-month time limit?
Well, now we're getting to sort of the classic, the old welfare program in its use in New York City. Cash assistance program, we call it now the cash assistance program. It used to be called public assistance and temporary assistance and welfare. It's got all sorts of names. To us, it's cash assistance because it's the one program that actually gives you a check and sends you money that you can spend any way you like if you're eligible. Given that comes with no strings attached and is just cash, and our belief that the first step toward out of poverty is a job, the first thing you get when you apply for cash assistance is you get instruction and guidance on how to get a job. Resume building, immediately refer you to a back-to-work provider, which is a not-for-profit or for-profit company. Its whole job is to get you ready to get into employment and get you placed with employers. We do allow for some training and education to go along in that part, but the federal rules are pretty clear. You need to be engaged in work or work-like activity pretty quickly, and we enforce those rules. So we say, listen, the training and education are important, but you got to get to work. So we also, if you can't find work or you're not finding activity that really qualifies, we also have what we call work experience program activity, which some people think of as workfare, where they have to be a certain place at a certain time and they have to do some usually menial labor of some kind. So that program is about getting people ready for and encouraged to get into the workplace. And it's worked. We put about 75,000-80,000 people a year into employment, and our caseload has remained strong because people really don't really want to receive a check and do nothing. They want to be active and involved, and so they go out and find employment and take advantage of that. Now, when President Clinton signed the bill, he also imposed a 5-year time limit on the receipt of this benefit in any one person's lifetime, one adult's lifetime. But New York State didn't like that idea. In our own wisdom, felt that, you never know, somebody could really be in difficulty, and we're not going to just cut people off and say you're done with receipt of benefits. So after 5 years in New York State, you transfer from a federally funded program, partially, but has federal dollars in it, to a state and local funded program called the Safety Net Program. So we still provide assistance to people even after 5 years, but we also still require them to work or be involved in work activities or take a transitional job or do things like that. So after 5 years, we still have an assistance program. But the core old federally funded, also has state and local funding and, quote, welfare program, which used to be an entitlement. You get this regardless of what you do, is gone in New York City. We don't do that. We give you a benefit, but we also expect you to do certain things. And there are, I don't want to mislead you, there are situations where you'd refuse to show up for an appointment or come in and see us and talk about your case. We will close your case and say you're not fulfilling your end of the bargain. But if you do all the things we ask you to do, there's a cash benefit involved. And that's part of the revolution that took place when President Clinton signed the bill, and New York City has implemented it, I think, successfully.
And to what extent do innovative partnership programs like MyDoor factor into your efforts?
Well, what we did there was we felt that once somebody had left the shelter system and gone back into to some form of permanent housing, we lost touch with them, and that transition wasn't very well maintained or monitored or in a way that was helpful to the client. So by setting up this program with the MyDoor program, we've allowed that connection to support services, to employment services, to social services, to be continued even after they leave the shelter system. That's a relatively new thing we put in place in the last couple of years. I have not seen the results. I hear good things, but I can't give you any numbers on them so far. But I think there's a sense that these families that had suffered this trauma of domestic violence needed a little additional help even after they left the shelter system so that there wasn't a recurrence of the domestic violence or that they were able to get their lives in better order.
Given we are living longer with chronic diseases, chronic illnesses, there's a growing need for long-term care. Would you tell us more about the home care services program?
New York City has a very well-developed infrastructure, unlike many other parts of the state, of providers of personal care and home care services. These are for-profit and not-for-profit firms that employ personal aides, not quite nurses, but a level below nurses in terms of their skills and abilities, but still an important job. And through our agency, we determine people's eligibility for these services based on income and need. And we assign an aide to that household or to that individual so that they can remain in the home and not have to go to a more institutional setting and also partly, although we could never completely eliminate, relieve the burden on the family member that may be trying to provide care. So we have now about 35,000 citizens in the city of New York who receive some form of home care. That allows them with to get through the day, whether it's laundry, food services, care with regard to sleeping and those sorts of things. We also have managed care programs, which we refer people to, that can provide maybe a more comprehensive level of service. Sometimes we refer people to nursing homes. But the theory is that there is less, if a person can remain in their home, we can provide them care at less cost than if we put them in a nursing home. In many cases, that's true, and we provide that service to low-income New York City residents.
I just have a minute, but what are some of the challenges you face given the unique demographic composition of New York in this program?
In this particular program involving personal care, the challenges are many. The demographics, New York City is a little older population. We have a little greater percentage of frail elderly. So there's a greater demand for the services. There's also a strong, depending on the ethnicity of the community, some communities welcome this and really take advantage of it aggressively, and others hardly use it at all. And it's kind of interesting to see different cultures and different ethnic groups respond to the availability of this service. I'm not so sure which is the right approach or the wrong approach, but it is different depending on the neighborhoods.
What about doing more with less? We will ask Robert Doerr, Commissioner of the New York City Human Resources Administration, to share with us when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.